This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. This hour, Illinois has approved recreational marijuana use. We'll discuss the new law and what it means going forward. Talking about climate change can be difficult, especially in parts of the Midwest, where there are plenty of skeptics. We'll hear how some find ways to have the conversation. A massive fire at a warehouse may have destroyed thousands of early master recordings, including some landmark rock and blues performances on the Chicago record label Chess.
People are going to be listening to this stuff centuries from now, and the ability to listen to it with a newfound clarity is going to be eye-opening, but that opportunity is lost if, in fact, that master recording is no longer there. You're going to only hear copies of copies.
We'll continue a discussion about shifting how teacher pensions are paid. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, getting help for those with mental illness can be a hurdle. The problem can be even worse for undocumented immigrants. Also, why is talking about climate change such a touchy subject here in the Midwest? And a loss of musical treasures, including many that document Chicago's rock and blues heritage. We'll hear about that and more on this week's Statewide. Governor J.B. Pritzker this week made Illinois the 11th state to allow recreational marijuana use. The issue has been discussed for decades. Now that a law is in place, what does it all mean? Our reporter Sam Dunklaw is here to fill us in. So, Sam, what does this legislation do?
So, now that the state has legalized recreational marijuana, adults 21 years or older, and it is important to emphasize that this is an adult-only product, may possess up to an ounce of marijuana. If you've ever seen that, that's about roughly a small plastic baggie full of marijuana flower. The amounts of things like THC concentrate, and THC, by the way, is the psychoactive chemical that's in marijuana, the amounts that you can have of that are quite a bit less, but you're able to possess both flower and concentrate as well as edible products if you're 21 years of age or older.
So what is the time frame for this? Because it's not as though come July 1st you can go out and purchase these products. You've got to wait a little bit.
Right. The state right now is working on getting the regulatory framework in place. Largely where you're going to be able to buy this stuff is at licensed dispensaries after January 1st. So we're going to have to wait at least another 6 months before this thing is up and going. The state is granting about 75 dispensary licenses initially. There's expected to be far more after the January 1st deadline. But most of these places are existing dispensaries. So, for example, some places here in central Illinois already have medical marijuana dispensaries. Those places will now be licensed to do retail sales as well.
So we see this CBD oil at a lot of different locations. That necessarily, those locations are not necessarily where you're going to see marijuana sales. You won't be able to go to a convenience store, at least up front here, and buy these products. It's going to have to go through more specialized or maybe even already licensed type of facilities.
Right, correct, because there's already a relationship between medical marijuana dispensaries and places like grow centers and processing facilities. The state wants to make sure that if we're going to allow this product to be sold legally, that it's sold in a place that already has an idea of how to sell this reasonably and safely to people.
So there are still some concerns out there, of course, that legal marijuana will send the wrong message. It'll send it to kids, even those under 21 who aren't supposed to have it, to say, the state endorses this idea. It's also some concerns among law enforcement out there as well.
I think I'd be careful to say that the state endorses marijuana, especially if we're talking about kids, because I think what the state is trying to send a message of more, or at least supporters have said this, is that the state does not endorse prohibition as it has for decades past. Supporters have largely said prohibition does not work. We're doing really nothing but drive this product underground. And many across the state are already using marijuana in its various forms. So why not put this out there and legalize it, tax it, and regulate it so that those who do want to participate can use it safely? And as far as the state police go, the state police do have a number of valid concerns, mostly being how do we make sure that somebody who's intoxicated from marijuana isn't driving on the road and making anybody else less safe. They're right now putting together a task force to figure out how other states have mitigated those risks and how we can implement some of the things that they're doing in Illinois. But a lot of that is still questionable. So the state police certainly have their hands full as far as that's concerned.
There's a social justice aspect to this whole legislation as well.
Yes. The supporters really wanted to garner votes by focusing this legislation on getting people who had been convicted of minor possession crimes for having pot, getting their criminal records wiped from the system so that they can have a clean start. A lot of these folks have either been fined heavily or they've spent time in jail for simply just having a small bag of weed when it was illegal. So the law allows somebody who had an arrest record specifically for having pot, allows that to be automatically expunged once a report is produced. For somebody who possessed was convicted of having pot, whether they had a fine or spent jail time, they're going to be able to qualify for the prisoner review board process, where they send their conviction record to the prisoner review board, and the prisoner review board will send a recommendation to the governor, after which the governor will be able to potentially pardon. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people here.
And finally, what does the government get out of this? There's tax money that's going to be coming into the state.
Right. Our outlet and others have reported that the tax revenue that they're estimating that this will bring in initially is only a little close to $60 million. Candidate Governor J.B. Pritzker, when he was on the campaign trail, had promised close to $1 billion. So the estimates have come down, I think, as we've realistically looked at how much this can foreseeably bring in with the number of locations that the state is going to allow. But they are anticipating that the tax revenue from that will increase as time goes on. They're estimating some $500 million over the next 5 years. How much that will help things like the budget and pensions, that's remained to be seen.
Governor Pritzker signing the recreational marijuana law this week, 11th state in the nation to allow it, but you won't be able to buy it until January 1st here in the state of Illinois. Sam, thanks once again.
Thanks, Sean.
Illinois is getting tougher on those who text while driving. Starting July 1st, a new law does away with the free pass that had been in place, letting offenders off with a warning the first time caught. That first time will now include a $75 fine, and it will count as a moving violation. Three of those in a year means a driver's license suspension. The latest numbers show a quarter of all accidents involve distracted driving. The numbers are even higher when teenagers are behind the wheel. I talk with Representative John D'Amico of Chicago. He's a Democrat who sponsored the original texting and driving law, as well as this change. In the beginning, people were being let off with that warning the first time, and you helped sponsor that legislation. At the time, did you think that was the best way to go?
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, we wanted to make sure people were, let's face it, I mean, at the time, cell phones were not new, but relatively making this texting and driving law was brand new. We wanted to make sure people had a chance to realize that what they were doing was against the law. We have too many distractions in our vehicles right now. Cell phones are a big part of that.
Did you hear from law enforcement regarding the need for a stricter law?
Absolutely. You know, I think there was 15,000 distracted driving tickets roughly last year. You know, there's always a need for it. I mean, as you drive down the roadway, I mean, we see right now the state police are even doing covert actions on out of a semi-truck, you know, trying to catch people texting and driving. I mean, we see it all the time when we're on the roadways. Do we want to make sure everybody gets from point A to point B in a safe manner and, you know, put the phone down?
Do you think that there may be other changes and even more crackdowns coming on this type of behavior that maybe you just didn't want to go to at this point, but could if the problem still persists?
You know what? There absolutely could be some changes that come. You know, we're learning as we go as well. And you look at it today, I mean, it's a huge problem. And who knows what new laws we could be coming up with in the future. You know, it's an ever-evolving issue.
Representative John D'Amico, he sponsored a new law that takes effect next week, toughening the penalties for texting while driving in Illinois. You can find out more about the changes at statewideshow.com. Back in 2008, a fire at Universal Studios Hollywood roared through a giant 22,000-square-foot warehouse. Almost everything in the vault was destroyed, and despite initial reports, there was more in that vault than just video.
Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring. If that diamond ring don't shine, he gonna take it to a private eye. If that private eye can't see.
An investigation published by the New York Times Magazine revealed the vault also housed tens of thousands of master tapes and some of the most historically significant music of the 20th century. Much of that music was recorded in Chicago under the storied blues label Chess Records. Lisa Labas of member station WBEZ talked with music critic Greg Kot of the show Sound Opinions about some of those treasures and why it matters that they're gone.
So the full scope of this fire is still being determined because it was massive. So give us an overview of what kinds of Chicago treasures were lost.
Well, a lot of speculation that most of the Chess Records master recordings were in that fire. Chess Records was a label founded in 1950 in Chicago, and it went on to become the leading blues label in the world, really. From a Chicago perspective, the loss of Chess Records master tapes, as well as the subsidiary labels like Checker and Argo, marks a huge swath of not only Chicago music history, but international music history.
Greg, could you lay out for people what is a master tape and why should we even care about it? I mean, I can still go listen to recordings of At Last by Etta James or Maybelline by Chuck Berry right now, and there are thousands of backups, so why does it matter that we lost the masters?
Well, the master recording is the first recording of a performance, and all other copies are made from that master. They're is a high-fidelity performance in a room by some of the legendary figures in modern music. And you will never get as close to being in that room as you would with that master recording. Everything else is a copy of that master recording, essentially. And by that criteria alone, inferior. There was an example used in the New York Times article. Think of it as a painting. The master recording is the Mona Lisa. Everything else is a copy of the Mona Lisa.
So, Greg, give us an example of just one song that really captures for you what we're talking about here, something from one of these giants we're talking about.
When you think about critical moments in music history, you know, you go back to being in the room on January 7th, 1954, when they recorded Hoochie Coochie Man, when Muddy Waters and his famed quintet recorded that song.
A gypsy woman told my mother before I was born.
This was a phenomenal combo, and it is an absolutely classic performance. You know, the Rolling Stones, a few years later, were sitting in their flat in London with their ears pressed against the speaker of the Chess recording of this song, trying to learn, A, how they got that sound, B, how can we possibly replicate this, and essentially form the foundation of their band.
One thing I kind of wonder about is all the stuff that we don't even know that might have been in that vault that burned. A guy who used to work at the warehouse told the New York Times that there were Chess Records boxes that just were labeled Session, and there were also Nirvana production masters with extra songs that nobody's ever heard.
Right. A lot of that stuff is really illuminating and really important, but just at the time, they decided, okay, we just need these 12 songs for a record. But meanwhile, there's 30 other recordings that were just left off and never returned to again. So imagine that times 10 with the entire roster of Chess Records in the 50s and 60s. We're talking about Bo Diddley, Willie Dixon, Chuck Berry, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, Buddy Guy, you know, giants of music who were in those studios several times a year making recordings and only having a fraction of that actually released to the public at the time.
Let's play another song here. Could you tee us up with another song that, as you say, is one of the greatest of the 20th century that was recorded here in Chicago? What do you got for us?
Well, I think with Chess, I think the other giant besides Muddy Waters was Chuck Berry. If Muddy was the architect of urban blues in many ways, Chuck Berry was the architect of rock and roll. I don't think it even quite had a name yet when Chuck was in Chess Studios and recorded Maybelline on May 21st, 1955.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do.
So if this were the master, what might you be able to hear Chuck Berry and the band do that we're just not hearing here on the radio?
I think you would hear just how driving that rhythm section was, you know, Willie Dixon on bass. You would be able to hear those maracas more clearly in the mix that Jerome Green is playing. So you get a more of a sense of, like, you can almost visualize the room that the song was recorded in your head. So it's a pretty profound difference if you care about that sort of thing. The point is that, you know, just like a Beethoven symphony, I think an early Chuck Berry song of this quality is one of those things that's absolutely timeless. I mean, people are going to be listening to this stuff centuries from now, and the ability to listen to it with a newfound clarity is going to be eye-opening. And but that opportunity is lost if, in fact, that master recording is no longer there. Now you're going to only hear copies of copies of that recording, and you will never get back to that source, original source tape.
The original Mona Lisa, right?
Right.
Well, that's music critic Greg Kot. He's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune and also co-host of WBEZ's Sound Opinions. Thanks so much, Greg.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Church bells ring.
That's Greg Kot talking with Lisa Labas about the fire at Universal Studios Hollywood back in 2008 and the master tapes of music lost, including many of those recorded in Chicago at the legendary Chess Records. Up next, working to get more kids into the state of Illinois' two boot camp detention facilities instead of prisons. More of Statewide ahead. We're back on Statewide. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we visit the town of Cairo in far southern Illinois. It's a community that has seen some good times and plenty of bad.
I've seen it in its heyday, and I see it today. And, well, it hurts.
We'll hear about an effort that some say could boost Cairo's fortunes. Next, the state of Illinois has a problem with its prison boot camps. Too many empty beds. The Department of Corrections runs two military-style programs in DuQuoin and Dixon Springs, but the facilities are at just 12% of capacity. And as Dana Vollmer reports, lawmakers are trying to boost that number.
It's rise and shine at 0530 for men in the DuQuoin Impact Incarceration Program. By 6, they're outside doing drills, scissor kicks, jumping jacks, and push-ups. Then it's time for a mile-long motivational run. Physical training is part of the routine at the boot camp. It's also used as punishment. Jason Henton is the program superintendent.
Well, that exercise there in itself is not that difficult. You can hear they're kind of winded. Just simply going to and from the exercise position is tedious.
These exercises are just one of the ways Illinois' correctional boot camps look to instill military-style discipline. Offenders march to and from assignments. They can only speak when spoken to and must address everyone as sir or ma'am. On the other hand, they get out sooner. The program in DuQuoin is designed to last 120 days. But not a lot of offenders are getting sent to boot camp. When I visited last month, DuQuoin had just 28 men. The facility can hold up to 300.
So, housing units. This is a traditional
We are walking between one of two identical dorms. The current population does not even come close to filling it. In the other dorm, mattresses are piled head high in the corner. Henton says it's been like this for a few years. Under current law, a judge must recommend an offender for boot camp. That hasn't been happening, and supporters say it's because people don't even know the program exists. Illinois lawmakers want to fix that by requiring a judge to say yes or no to boot camps in all cases where the offender is eligible. But criminal justice experts say low participation has more to do with who qualifies in the first place. Offenders can only go to boot camp if they're between the ages of 18 and 36, convicted of a nonviolent crime, and sentenced to fewer than 8 years in prison. Dave Olson, a criminologist at Loyola University Chicago, says there's been a shift away from sending people like that to prison. Instead, they get probation or held in the county jail. He also says the popularity of boot camps peaked in the 90s, after the Gulf War.
It was based on a false premise that what criminals need is the kind of discipline you get in a boot camp. You know, we're going to humiliate them, we're going to shave their head, we're going to yell at them, which appeased the public, because at the time that was what the public wanted, was punishment and retribution.
Back at DuCoin, Superintendent Henton says his boot camp has evolved with the times.
We have a kind of a therapeutic treatment community now. And I promise you, in 1998, when I was an officer here, we did not have that. We were drill sergeants, and security was first, and you didn't have any feelings, and it didn't matter what you were going to do on day 121.
Offenders spend hours each day in programs on substance abuse, anger management, fatherhood, and more. Dustin Michaels is at DuCoin for meth possession. He says the physical training is helping his body recover from drug use, and for the first time, he's getting addiction counseling.
Being with other people that have been in the same situation helps out a great deal. When you haven't been through it, you don't know. You know, you kind of feel isolated, alone. To know that there's other people with the same feelings and to see how they get through it helps out a lot.
Olson, the criminologist, says it's these kinds of services, not the paramilitary structure, that reduce the likelihood someone will commit another crime. But he says research shows the benefits of boot camp are short-lived. Long-term, recidivism rates stay almost the same.
If it doesn't reduce recidivism or anything like that, what it does do is it shortens the length of time in prison.
That might have value for a prison system that's as overcrowded as Illinois is. But Olson says selling it as a crime reduction strategy doesn't hold much water. I'm Dina Vollmer.
Two arts organizations are using state grants to help extend their seasons in different directions. We hear from Guy Stevens.
It's early June, and Timberlake Playhouse Executive Director Dan Danielowski is pointing out work being done on the lobby, really an open walkway outside its theater, by a team of electricians. The schedule is tight, but so far so good.
And we should be able to work this project around production. Like today, we have a 2 o'clock matinee, so at 1 o'clock, they'll close up for the day and off they go.
A fundraising campaign capped by a matching grant from the Illinois Office of Tourism this year is allowing the organization to, as Danielowski puts it, winterize its facility. Once the lobby is enclosed, workers will add a heating system to service it and the theater proper. That will allow Timberlake to extend its season well into the fall and someday beyond, he says. It's been a long time coming. Timberlake Playhouse was founded in 1961 on this wooded site near Mount Carroll in northwestern Illinois. Danielowski says the first building was rather primitive, as was a replacement that opened in 1975.
Because it was built as a summer theater, there's very little insulation. There was no air conditioning, no heat. It was cooled just with fans and cross ventilation. But after a while, they realized that that was just not enough, and they needed to put in air conditioning. But still, they didn't have heat.
Along the way, he says, patrons began asking about doing more shows. Local businesses were supportive of the idea, too.
From the first day that I came here, what I was hearing, when I said, what can TLP do to help the area? It was always expand the season.
Danielowski says the theater drew about 29,000 people last year. He estimates the longer season now being planned will draw another 4,500 to 6,000 people annually. And despite once calling summer theater, quote, racing at 100 miles an hour with your hair on fire, he's excited at the opportunity. While Timberlake Playhouse is winterizing, an organization in DeKalb is looking to, if you will, summarize its facility. The Egyptian Theater was built 90 years ago with an opulent pseudo-Egyptian theme, but without air conditioning. That's made hosting events in the summer nearly impossible. Alex Neared is the Egyptian's executive director. He says a number of age-related issues, worn-out seats and such, were addressed over the years, but a big push began several years ago to raise money for a real do-over. A recently awarded $200,000 matching grant from the State Office of Tourism put the topper on the $4.5 million project.
It's both an expansion of the theater, a two-story expansion, expanding restrooms and the concession stand storage, but probably most importantly, providing the space for new mechanical equipment to air condition the theater.
Neerad says upkeep costs run year-round, so he's excited about being able to generate revenue during the summer. That will help the theater's bottom line, and it doesn't stop there.
You have, you know, this huge population, the NIU students, for the most part, is gone through the summer months. And then you take the Egyptian Theater offline through those summer months, it makes it really tough downtown.
It's not just patrons and businesses who welcome the renovations. The Egyptian's marketing and communications director, Janine Holcomb, has warm memories, in more ways than one, of performing in dance recitals here from age 3 through high school.
I very much remember the heat and humidity and being in sequins and feathers up in the balcony and sweating, and God bless our mothers who had to deal with all of those sweating little children.
Neerad says 40,000 people came through the doors of the Egyptian last year. He hopes to increase attendance to more than 50,000 within a few years of the project's completion in early 2020. In the end, we're talking about some pretty unglamorous stuff here, plumbing, heating and cooling systems and the like. But if it brings out more people to appreciate what their respective venues have to offer and helps their neighbors to boot, well, that would make both Danielowski and Neerad very happy. I'm Guy Stevens.
Each week, Statewide brings you reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find our episodes and links to the stories at our website at statewideshow.com. Midwest agriculture depends on the Mississippi River to cheaply move grain and products. However, high water has stranded some barges this year. And as Madeline Beck reports, that may actually be an opportunity for Illinois' southernmost city.
A standard river barge can hold 1,500 tons of product. In early June, about 640 of them sat on the river near American Commercial Barge Line's office outside Cairo, Illinois.
That's just me. That's not the other fleets in here.
That's Mark Glab, the facility manager there for ACBL. Its boats tow these barges full of fertilizers for farmers and steel up and down the river.
I get 3 or 4 calls a day with people wanting to be able to unload their barges here into trucks or into trains because we can't go on the river until the water goes down.
The problem is they can't unload at Cairo. There's no port. And this could be a growing problem as water levels trend upwards, keeping barges waiting longer.
The only difference this year is the length of time, but it seems to get worse every year.
And a port seems obvious. Cairo's near the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. It's near railroads and interstates. But previous Cairo port projects failed because of river or funding issues. The town is struggling. Larry Klein is chairman of the local Port Authority Board. He's also fourth generation Cairo and has seen the town's booms and busts.
You know, you can understand never having nothing, but to have had everything and lost it all, something was wrong.
Cairo was once a hub of rural southern Illinois with more than 15,000 people. Many residents did well up into the 1950s, except the town's black community. They had no representation and few opportunities. During the 60s civil rights movement, they fought for equal rights. Boycotts sprang up, riots broke out, buildings burned. On top of it all, a new interstate bypassed the town completely. Misused funds, racism, and missed opportunities has left Cairo, Illinois, with about 2,000 people, no grocery stores, no gas stations, and in the last year, several hundred residents were forced to leave when their public housing units were condemned. Here's Klein again.
I've seen it in its heyday, and I see it today. And, well, it hurts. I want to stay around and say that, you know, I knew the people that help get us back on the right track.
An Illinois capital funding bill includes $150 million for port projects this coming year. Cairo asked for half that to build their port, but they'll compete against 18 other port districts. If they don't get enough money, Klein says they'll start to build port infrastructure to entice private investors. If they do get funds, people at Shawnee Community College say they can help train local kids to get jobs associated with the port. Kathleen Curfee is vice president of academic affairs there, and she's worked in port communities before.
We have developed captain's training, we have developed seaman's training, all the different many types of training that you will find as that port develops in the Carroll area.
Former Mayor Tyrone Coleman said in April that there's no limit to what this port could bring. Maybe a few trucking jobs here, then a gas station there, people moving back.
And that's the excitement of it all, is the unknown factor. Kind of like bring the past back, but at least bring it to a point where there is opportunity. And that's what's been lacking in this most southern part of Illinois over the years.
Still, this port could take 5 years to build if they get all the funding. And that's a big if with a $75 million price tag. But Klein argues the Cairo port is a solid business plan with barges waiting at their doorstep.
We just need a boost. I know there's others that do too, but we just feel like we've been forsaken.
The governor is expected to sign a capital funding bill in the next few weeks, which should show how port communities like Cairo vie to get their chunk of that $150 million. Madeline Beck, Illinois Newsroom.
In the Midwest, especially in rural areas, the number of people who believe in climate change is growing, but it can still be a touchy subject. For Harvest Public Media, Marley Baldridge went in search of the creative ways that people bring up climate change in conversation without saying those words.
Mark Junker usually helps clean up hazardous waste sites with the Sac and Fox Tribal Nation of Missouri in Kansas and Nebraska's environmental department. But today, he'll drive 6 hours between Kansas, Iowa, and his home in Falls City, Nebraska, delivering flyers that summarize regional climate change to tribal clinics and facilities.
Sometimes pays to make the drive.
Hello.
Hello, how are you guys today?
Good, how are you?
Well, I brought some more. I started making them after seeing how they were done at the Wind River Reservation. I thought it would be something to be useful for the four Kansas tribes to have as a reference tool, a decision-making tool.
He's in Hiawatha, Kansas today, in Brown County, home to nearly 10,000 people, and 61% of them believe in global warming, according to Yale's Program on Climate Change Communication. This challenges the stereotype that, in flyover country, folks don't believe in climate change. As Paula Dennison and anyone else who's lived in a rural place can tell you, it's not that simple.
No, not at all.
Dennison is the assistant city manager of Stillwater, Oklahoma. Most people believe in global warming here, just like in Hiawatha. Not that everyone would call it that.
Oh, we talk about it, but no, we don't. We don't use the term climate change.
It's hard for her to describe what Oklahomans view, but when she talks about climate change in terms of what people can do and connects them to resources, Dennison finds that folks are much more likely to buy into a solution than a problem. She's not the first one to figure this out.
When was the last time you heard a whippoorwill at night? How many hoot owls do you hear at night as opposed to how many you used to hear? You know, things like that to get people to think about, well, yeah, you know, things have changed a lot in a relatively short amount of time.
Jane Ellen Ross hosts living history workshops, like how to make medicine from plants, near her home in Huntsville, Arkansas. Huntsville has a population of a little more than 2,300 people, and more than half believe in global warming. She says that when people talk about the past, they don't realize they're talking about the effects of climate change. This spring, the Missouri River flooded parts of Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. Junker says that people in the area were calling it a 100-year flood, except that the label doesn't really mean anything anymore.
It's like you're having a 100-year flood happening every 5 or 6 years.
The most recent National Climate Report says that because rural communities depend more on the land but have fewer resources, like extensive infrastructure or political clout, or less affluent, the people that live there face what's called the climate gap. That means that people may need to drive 30 miles to recycle their glass and plastic. It might mean that they don't have reliable internet to even find out about recycling programs in the first place. To close the gap, Junker, Ross, and Dennison feel the answer is to keep talking, however possible. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Marley Baldridge. Thank you.
Coming up, a teachers union response to an interview we aired earlier on Statewide. That's next. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, we'll learn about the hurdles that undocumented immigrants face when seeking mental health treatment. We'll hear from a father who's worried about his son. That's still on the way. Low-income college students in Illinois got some good news this week. The state's monetary award program, which provides MAP grants to help pay for tuition, will be able to give more grants with more money, thanks to an extra $50 million the General Assembly appropriated. Lynn Baker's with the Illinois Student Assistance Commission and says the agency approved a new formula to boost grants by an average of $220 and cover at least 6,700 more students.
So there's always a balancing act there, because you want an award to be large enough so that it's meaningful enough for a student to be able to go to school, but you also want to serve as many students as possible.
The formula for how many students get aid and how much they get is based on input from the Illinois Association of Financial Aid Administrators. Up next, who should pay pension costs for Illinois teachers and school administrators? Currently, the state bears virtually all the cost, leaving school districts free to negotiate benefits without worrying about the price tag. As listeners to Statewide heard earlier this month, the education advocacy group called Stand for Children hopes to persuade lawmakers to shift pension costs to districts by integrating them into the new school funding formula. That group's legislative director, Jessica Handy, calls it an equity boost. This week, we bring you a response from the Illinois Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, whose lobbyist, Will Lovett, spoke with our education reporter, Dusty Rhodes.
I know you guys are just adamantly opposed to pension cost shift, is that right?
That is correct. Because we look at the shifting of pensions on the local school district as just another way to divert resources at the local level that would have gone to help educate students. It would just be simply a diversion of resources that would have stayed in the classroom in local school districts and sends them to Springfield.
So I get your point, but it would be rolled into each district's adequacy target. So
yeah, I mean, they've kind of rebranded what was a shift of the actual normal cost to local school districts, and we've pushed the normal cost into the new funding formula, and then kind of recalibrate, I guess, what districts would receive. Either way you look at it, under the equity boost is what Stand for Children calls it. It's still, as she stated in her interview with you, that it creates winners and losers. And the reason education funding reform was embraced was because it did not create winners and losers. It did not take from any one district to give to another. But under what Stand for Children's proposing, and Jessica stated it, about 100 districts would actually lose some funding if they do this equity boost, as they describe it, or this cost shift.
But, I mean, you can surely admit that the pension system is in need of some reform, right?
Well, I'm not sure if shifting who pays for pensions is considered reform. It's about who's paying the bill.
The way it is right now, a district doesn't really have a reason to really consider pension costs, especially for administrators.
Well, I would disagree with that, because there has been reform, if you will. Downstate suburban teachers, those who participate in TRS, they now have what's called the 6% salary limitation. Downstate suburban teachers are the only teachers in the state that have that type of limitation on their pensionable earnings. But districts do have skin in the game when it comes to salaries in excess of $180,000 or the equivalent of the governor's salary, because there was legislation passed, I believe, in 2016, 2017, and I believe I shared that with you the last time we chatted, that any salary in excess of the governor's salary, the local employer would pay the pension costs for that salary.
Okay, time out.
Mm-hmm.
Any salary that's higher than the salary for the governor of the entire state.
Correct.
That's where we draw the line. You know,
that's where the General Assembly has drawn the line.
Do you understand how that sounds to normal people?
I'm just saying the current law states that the General Assembly has passed legislation to.
Yeah, I understand. I understand what you're saying, and you're happy with it there. But to most people, that's kind of, you know, I mean, we've got superintendents with 300 kids in a district. We've got superintendents with 100 kids in a district. And as long as they don't make more than the governor, okay, that's your argument. What about the argument that some districts are getting $1,700 per student per year for pensions, while the average is about $500? That's fine with you?
Well, you've got to look at it, and the funding reform that was passed in 2017 actually acknowledges this, that there are differences. They have regionalization factors, which recognize that in some areas of the state, there's a different cost to provide and deliver educational services.
So the district that I can name off the top of my head that's in the story, Rondout, where we're paying $1,773 per year per student, there's evidence that they need that compared to Taylorville, where we're paying about $325 per student per year?
I would push back and say this, that, I mean, local school boards are elected by local voters, and they have the ability every 2 years to go into the voting booth and make changes to the school board if they don't like what school boards are negotiating at the local level. So whatever is negotiated at the local level is done with by elected representation by local voters.
Right. But whatever Rondout does about electing their school board, and whatever their school board negotiates for their superintendent or their principal, it's the state that's paying a giant chunk of that pension. I don't have any voice in the Rondout School District. I live in Springfield. So I don't understand how that argument applies.
Well, in a sense, by the state picking up those costs, it does actually alleviate some pressure at the local level with regards to property tax. And in a sense, that is one way that the state has chosen to assist with the funding of education.
So we created the evidence-based funding model to level the playing field and to say state funds need to run through this formula so that they'll be given out on a more equitable basis, right?
Mm-hmm.
The pension funds do not go through the equitable formula.
The school funding formula has regionalization factors, and it does recognize that there are different costs of delivering education in certain areas of the state, and increases funding to those areas where more resources are needed, as outlined within the almost 24 criteria.
Well, there's 34, so it's more than 24. But yes, there's regionalization, but the 34 criteria are not geographic. The 34 criteria are based on the needs of the kids, like English language learners. And if you just applied regionalization to the pension, you know, like if you said $500 is the average per student, let's apply a regionalization factor to that. You know, that's from like what, 0.9 to 1.75 or something like that. That's pretty narrow compared to $1,700 versus $350.
But I would go back to my original comments in this conversation is that the beginning of the education funding model and the discussions around its creation started with the premise that we are not going to take away from any districts. This dramatic change would take away from districts and would create losers of at least 100 school districts in the state.
Okay.
Of at least 100 school districts in the state.
All right. Do you have a different plan? Do you have an alternative proposal?
I guess to accomplish what?
To address the inequity in the pension system.
I hear what you're saying with regards to inequities, but the state is funding the same percentage of salary to fund educator pensions, whether they are in Taylorville or in Freeport
or in Decatur or Danville or Round Isle, as you said.
Will Lovett is a lobbyist for the Illinois Education Association, and he spoke with our education reporter, Dusty Rhodes. This is Statewide. Undocumented immigrants face many barriers to getting help when it comes to mental illness, and without treatment, they may act out and get in trouble with the law. That can have serious consequences, like deportation. For Side Effects Public Media, Christine Herman has a story about one father who fears for his son's future.
Jose and his wife left Mexico and moved to the U.S. with their young children nearly two decades ago.
Fue por una mejor manera de vivir para mis hijos.
I came to give my kids a better life. In Mexico, it's hard to make enough to survive.
Jose is his middle name. He asks that we protect his identity since he's undocumented, as is his now 21-year-old son, who got diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder last year. Around that time, Jose says his son started acting aggressively and talked about hearing voices.
He
asked us for help, but we didn't know how to help him. He'd say, Dad, I feel like I'm going crazy.
Jose's son spent weeks in an inpatient psychiatric unit last year. Once, he began driving erratically, saying his car was telling him what to do. The next month, he talked about wanting to die and started walking in the middle of a busy street. But Jose says those hospitalizations didn't seem to make a difference, and at the time, his son didn't want more help.
He's totally lost. He says no, that he doesn't need help, but he doesn't realize the problem he has.
Jose's son agreed to talk to me, but didn't want to be recorded. He told me that last year he did meet with a therapist a few times and was taking medication he was prescribed in the hospital. He says medication helped, but without insurance, he couldn't afford $180 a month for the prescription. Back off meds, he struggled. That's a common problem for undocumented immigrants, says Carrie Chapman of the Legal Counsel for Health Justice in Chicago.
And it's just excruciating for families and for advocates. It's an incredible crisis that a vulnerable young person with serious mental illness falls through the cracks.
While undocumented children in Illinois and five other states can receive health insurance through Medicaid, they lose coverage at age 19. Chapman says that's right around when many people, like Jose's son, experience their first episode of psychosis. Andrea Kovach is a healthcare attorney at the Shriver National Center on Poverty Law in Chicago. She says 4 million adults living in the U.S. without legal status are uninsured and ineligible for Medicaid or insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And without treatment, their lives can spiral out of control.
Time and time again, too many young adults have entered the criminal justice system for the exact reason that there just aren't mental health services ready to help them.
That's what happened to Jose's son. Police were called after several violent outbursts at their home in Illinois. During the most recent incident in January, Jose's son was arrested after he broke a window and got into a fight with his brother-in-law. For an undocumented immigrant, criminal charges could mean deportation. At a court hearing in May, the judge gave Jose's son a warning.
If you are not a U.S. citizen, you are hereby advised that conviction of the offense for which you have been charged may have the consequences of deportation, exclusion from admission to the United States, or denial of that.
Jose's son pleaded guilty to several charges, including damage to property. He was sentenced to probation for 18 months, so as long as he stays out of trouble, he can stay out of jail. But his criminal record makes him a target for immigration officials. Jose worries about that, even though his son is back on medication and seems to be doing better.
Si llega él a ser deportado, prácticamente él va a estar perdido en México porque él no conoce México.
If he gets deported, he'll practically be lost in Mexico because he doesn't know Mexico. I brought him here very young, and with his illness, where is he going to go? They're essentially putting him on the street.
Advocates say the only long-term solutions include expanding Medicaid to cover everyone regardless of legal status and creating a pathway to citizenship for people like Jose's son. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
That wraps up another edition of Statewide. Thanks for tuning in, and be with us again next week at this time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Reminder to go to our website, statewideshow.com, to find all of our episodes. You can also find our contact information. We'd like to hear from you. And don't forget, our podcast is available through NPR One. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.